Christianity has gotten a bad rap, at least conservative Christianity. The belief is that Christians are puritanical. Now, so when non-Christians imagine what Bible-believing Christians are like, I think they probably picture someone like Alice from the best Christmas pageant ever. Now, I haven't actually seen the new version yet, but I know the book, I know the 80s movie, and in that story, this Christmas pageant that a church puts on is it kind of happens a little differently than normal for that town. It's the Christmas pageant where this one particular group of kids, the Herdmans, decide to be a part of it for the first time. And so in the words of the book, the Herdmans were absolutely the worst kids in the history of the world. They lied and stole and smoked cigars, even the girls, and talked dirty and hit little kids and cussed their teachers and took the name of the Lord in vain and set fire to Fred Shoemaker's old broken down tool house. So there's a little girl in the book named Alice who's one of their greatest critics, or worst critics, I guess, to the point that she has a notebook that she tallies. She keeps track of all the bad things that this group of kids do during these play practices. And I think that's what Christians may imagine, or non-Christians rather, may imagine Christians are like. You know, we're puritanical killjoys, just like where that word comes from, the Puritans. Right, so you've heard maybe the quip about Puritans by H.L. Mencken. He said, Puritanism is the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy. Now, Puritans, they're often pictured as dressed in black, and they are often assumed to have believed that marital intimacy was purely for the purposes of procreation and nothing more. But guess what? There are practices you might take issue with Puritans, but they actually dressed just as colorfully as everybody in their day. And preachers, Puritan preachers, actually spoke on the duty of desire, which had to do with the fact that spouses owe their spouse their duty to carry out that marital intimacy. So they encouraged married couples to engage in it willingly, often, and cheerfully. And they actually practiced church discipline on and removed one husband from membership, at least one husband from membership, for withholding from his wife, who complained to the pastor first and then to the whole congregation. Now, that's not what you picture with Puritans, is it? But the fact is, God is not prudish. I think some people may think of him the way that you sometimes picture the Puritans. They may think that he's up in heaven just worrying about somebody somewhere having fun. He doesn't want that to happen. That's nothing could be further from the truth. God invented sex. He's the one who made that. He created it. He designed it. He's not trying to keep people from it. What he's trying to do is help people enjoy it to the full. He knows how to do that. He designed it. He's the inventor. He knows how it works best. He also knows how it can be misused, how it can be perverted. Now, here's something to consider. If you heard what I just said about God and you think it's inappropriate, you might be part of the problem. You might just be part of the reason why Christianity is misunderstood. See, there are some people who claim to be Christians, and yet they misrepresent what it's about. But that's exactly why a passage like the one we found, and actually it's exactly why going through Scripture passage by passage is so helpful, because it guards you against two extremes, at least for a pastor. There is the provocateur, you know, the pastor who likes to say risque things from the pulpit because they like to get people's attention, and even because they like to make conservative people feel uncomfortable. So that person might take from some of these verses just to be provocative. But then there is, and so they don't actually pay attention to the whole passage, but then there's the conservative pastor who picks different topics to speak on, and they may talk about some of the things in this passage, but they're not going to talk about all of those things, because I guarantee you, conservative pastors like myself would not pick all that's in this passage to bring up and talk about. So that's the beauty of this passage. It helps us understand one of the major problems with sin. See, it's not that sin involves inherently wrong desires. The desires may be good. The problem is how people go about trying to satisfy those desires. And the desire in question here is a powerful one. A Song of Songs 8:6 describes it with these words. Love is as strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. And then just before that, it gives this warning not to stir up or awaken love until the appropriate time. There is an appropriate time to satisfy sexual desires in a way that God designed them to be satisfied. But doing that outside of marriage is always the wrong way. Now the son, he's actually the original audience for this passage. He was married. So the specific warning here is about adultery. That's involving a married person engaging in this kind of intimacy with someone outside of his marriage, someone that is not his spouse. But certainly the things that we're talking about includes the reality that anyone not married, married or not rather, anybody married or not, satisfying these desires outside of marriage is wrong, no matter what your marital status is. But the focus, again, of this passage is on those who are married. So it's addressing adultery. And as wisdom in Proverbs often does, you could picture this as a path. This is one of the paths, the many paths you need to steer clear of, you need to stay off of. And so what we see in this passage is really four ways to stay off of the path of adultery. And those four ways are: spot the false advertising, avoid the consequences, take the antidote, and recognize the reality. Those are the four ways that Proverbs 5 tells us to stay off the path of idolatry. Spot the false advertising, avoid the consequences, take the antidote, and recognize the reality. So you could turn to Proverbs 5 if you're not already there. Again, it's on page 497 in the Bible there in the pew. And in these first six verses, we're going to see the first way that you stay off the path of adultery, and it's to spot the false advertising. My dad was often upset about McDonald's false advertising. Now, we didn't go out to eat very often, but if we did, it would be a place like McDonald's. And so my dad would order either, you know, a Big Mac or a quarter pounder, and he'd open it up, and he'd always say something like, "Look at this. You know, is this what the picture looks like?" I mean, he even brought it up once and said, does this look like that? You know, he thought, I shouldn't have to pay for this if what I'm wanting is that, if I'm ordering that. It's false advertising. He was very upset about it. Now, that's one thing, you know, a sandwich that doesn't look like the picture. But false advertising is an even greater problem if you advertise a product that doesn't actually do what you say it's going to do. And Volkswagen, that German automobile company, got in some big trouble recently for doing just that. They had some of these vehicles that were said to be environmentally friendly and complied with emission standards. But what was actually going on? What was actually happening is they had installed a device in their cars, in these vehicles that were supposed to be environmentally friendly, that actually changed the performance of the vehicle, that it was able to actually identify when emissions tests were happening, and so it changed the performance of the vehicle so that it would pass the test. But it didn't function that way when you normally used it. They had to settle in court for like some $10 billion. It's a costly example of false advertising. Adultery is the same problem. It promises something that it cannot provide. It's false advertising. So the father here directs his son to wisdom that he received from God. So he's not just saying, hey, this is what I've found in life. He's passing on divine truth. And he explains that it's for the purpose in verse 2, that you keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. So he's saying to keep a close watch on what he calls discretion. It's a word we've seen already in Proverbs. It has to do with being able to think through situations, think through different options that you have, and choose the right one. And so he's saying that this is what you need to make sure to do, to have this discretion. But even more specifically, he says that his lips are to guard knowledge. Again, knowledge is synonymous with wisdom, understanding, discretion. And so this divine insight that he's passing down is supposed to make sure that this son acts wisely with his lips. You can do a couple things with your lips, right? This could be talking about speech. But based on verse 3, I think it's not just talking about speech. Verse 3 explains why you have to be careful with your lips. It says, for the lips of the forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. So mentioned in verse 2, this Hebrew word here translated forbidden woman, basically just seems like it means a person who is not your spouse. And this woman who's not this son's spouse, her lips drip honey. Honey is obviously sweet. This particular honey, it's not the normal word for honey. It's one that refers to especially sweet honey. So it could be a reference to speech. You know, it's something that you want to hear. But it could also point to something else you like to do with your lips, like kissing. I think that actually is what it's talking about in this first part. The Hebrew word in the second line isn't actually speech. It's a word, you could translate it palate. So it's a kind of synonymous, but it's a different part of a person's mouth. And it could be used to talk about taste. It could be used to talk about speech. And when it compares this with oil and really with the smoothness of that oil, it does seem like that is talking about speech. So if you think in this context, what kind of speech you'd want to be avoiding and be careful of, you're talking about flirting. You're talking about enticing somebody with your words. So this woman is trying to attract this man to her, and so there's that temptation both to respond in kind, to flirt back, and to kiss. And so I should say at this point, this instruction is specifically here for this son, but it applies across the board. Now, a wife should avoid flirting with someone who's not her husband and guard against kissing someone else just as much as a husband should, and we have the same temptations. So, I mean, they're specific to ourselves personally, but we need to all do this. Like the son, we need to keep our mind in this divine wisdom so that in a given moment we can keep our head and not flirt with, not kiss somebody who is not our spouse. Why not? Because what we're seeing in that moment is false advertising. Even though her lips look like they're dripping with honey, and what's coming out of her mouth is as smooth as oil, the truth is what verse 4 says. It says, in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. What's hard to convey in English is that phrase there, two-edged sword. The Hebrew is actually sword of mouths. So you can see another comparison. So her lips aren't sweet, they're bitter. Her palate isn't smooth. Her mouth is this sharp sword that can sink into you and kill you. And that's what verse 5 goes on to warn. She's not describing somebody who makes love like a female praying mantis. If you know anything about them, they tend to kill the person when they're done with it. That's not talking about murder here. It's talking about what following this path leads to. It says her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. So again, you have this kind of, what's somewhat vague in Proverbs, this concept of life and death, it gets more clear in the progress of Revelation so that we know that this death is not just about not living anymore. There's something worse than just physical death, as John refers to as second death. So there is a path here. This path leads to not simply having a short time in the land of the living, but having an eternal time in the land of death, where Jesus says there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the pursuit of adultery is leading you toward eternal separation from God. Verse 6 describes then that she's not even considering the path of life. Now, that's what sometimes I think people thinks that this person would be thinking about, the path of life, really living. And you might have heard somebody talk about real living. Now, real living is thought to be not being afraid of pursuing your hopes and dreams and desires, pursuing them, not letting them pass you by. But if you've heard that, again, that's false advertising, because that's not real life. It's not the real, deep experience of life that God actually designed us to experience. The result of living in a way that just tries to satisfy your desires is a way that doesn't actually ponder what true life is. What it does is it just follows meandering paths where the person doesn't even know where they're going to end up next. That's what verse 6 is describing. So, God gave us desires. He's the one who gave those to us. He wants us to satisfy those the way that he's designed. But he did not give those desires a guidance system. So your desires cannot guide you. It's not that your desires should direct you in how to satisfy them. They haven't They're an unreliable guide. They fluctuate. They change. That's not what they're designed to do. God provides guidance to truly satisfy those desires without the consequences that come from doing that outside of his boundaries. So God's not trying, his wisdom is not trying to keep us from satisfying our desires. What he's trying to do is to show us the way to do that that avoids the consequences outside of the bounds. And that's what the Father goes on to talk about. The second way to stay off the path of adultery is to avoid the consequences. And this avoidance is, don't even get close to it. Father, he broadens this wisdom to not just his son, but his son's son's sons. He's broadening it to future generations when he says sons in verse 7. He says, and now, O sons, listen to me and do not depart from the words of my mouth. And he's saying, you can't afford to even step foot on this path. Verse 8 says, keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house. So you can hear how emphatic he is. Stay far away, don't get near. Don't even get to the door of the house. Why not? Because of the consequences. He spells out two major consequences here, ruin and regret. It's hard for us, we're separated from this culture and these environments, it's hard for us to know exactly what the situation was that these verses describe, and there's lots of opinions about what it was. But what we can say is that these verses are, first of all, describing ruin. So in some way, adultery caused this person at the time to be connected to others outside his family. So there were implications to adultery that spread him thin. Whatever made people look at that person as significant before the adultery was given away after the affair. And the Father here makes sure to note that this is a personal responsibility. The person has done this to themselves. He says, lest you give your honor to others. So it's not like this is just an unintended consequence. Sure, it's not unintended by him, but it's going to happen, and he's responsible for it. So that reputation, that honor that he had worked for in life throughout the years, he loses that in a moment to what's described as a merciless person. They're merciless because they can't show pity for this. There's no way to pity this. They can't stop the way that they now think about that person. Now that the affairs occurred, there's irreparable things. You can't go back after you commit adultery. The language of verse 10, it seems very similar to the description of the adulteress. So it's describing people somehow connected to her. She's a stranger. She's somebody who is not connected to this son's family. And now he's connected to people related to her too, people connected to her family, her community. So again, this person's being spread thin. He's divided now, not just working for his own household, but now he has other people to be thinking about and caring about. So there's more people that are going to take his energy, more people that he has to use his strength and power to provide for. Verse 11 goes on to starts to talk about this regret, but it describes the situation that he's in, this ruin, as when your flesh and body are consumed. You could translate that finished, spent. So when your sexual activity goes outside your house, it's going to wear you out. So this reality, adultery, can affect you economically by giving you more people that you now have to provide for. It can affect you physically if you do this with someone from whom you can contract a disease. It could affect you socially because now people cannot trust you. How? Why would someone think that you're not going to cross the line that you've already crossed? These are irreparable things. Verse 14 then describes it as utter ruin, and it describes this larger community. It uses language from Israel's world, translated assembled congregation. So when affairs become known, they don't just affect your personal relationships. Sometimes they affect how people know you in the community. You are generally known now as someone who's done this. So this is describing the potential for it to ruin everything in your life. No way to get that back. So even if only some of these things happen, it is not worth it. That's what this is describing. And because of the ruin, The father here says that you're going to finish your time on earth with regret. Verse 11 describes this regret. It says, at the end of your life, you groan. It's a cry of distress. It's a description of somebody who's truly and deeply bothered by something. It just hangs over them, and it comes out in this visceral response. And then verse 12 gives voice to the groan. It says that the person thinks about their choice, and they say, how I hated discipline, and my heart despised reproof. At the time, they didn't think anyone trying to steer them away from this was good and kind to them. They refused to listen to what they were saying. They didn't want to pay attention to anything anyone had to say that was just warning them. They hated it. They deeply despised any instruction to turn away. So when you let these kinds of desires take hold of you, you can't stand anybody telling you not to fulfill them, not to satisfy them the way that you want to. You can't stand that. Might even say that someone who actually does care about us, that they must really not be our friend because they're not being supportive. I mean, we can have that kind of mentality. We will easily think of all kinds of negative ideas about people when they're getting in the way of what we want to get at. And so this is describing a person who now thinks they did hate the people that were telling them not to do this, but now this person is regretting it. These are words of regret. They're now saying, what an idiot I was to have that attitude, to hate what other people were warning me about. They regret the fact they didn't listen to this biblical wisdom, but they didn't pay attention to what God says. And all they can do now that they've done it is live in this state of being on the brink of utter ruin, as verse 14 says. So there's nothing but regret in the end for this person when they think about what they've done. So in the moment, these ideas come into your head. In the moment, it can seem like satisfying this strong desire is the best thing to do with somebody else. But then if you think about it, if you indulge that desire, it becomes even more and more stronger. And you can even think, well, this is irresistible. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't help myself. You are actually encouraging it. And the fact is in that moment, when you are tempted, you need to consider these consequences. You need to think about this. Think about how your life is going to change forever if you commit adultery. There is no going back to the way things were. Now, for the person who's done that, there is forgiveness, and maybe even the individuals involved will forgive you, but that doesn't change the consequences. So God forgives, but there are consequences that continue, and that's what he's warning us to say, stay far away from that, because you cannot get rid of those consequences once you do that. And you will live with those consequences. You will live with lifelong regret. So don't do it. Avoid the consequences. Stay off that path. The third way to stay off the path of adultery is to take the antidote. So turns to the positive. And again, because of the children in the room, I didn't read all the verses, but we're still going to talk about that. And if you're married, you should read these verses. You should reread these verses. Because often the best defense is a good offense. And that's what these verses are talking about. So when you correctly satisfy your desires, desires that adultery is trying to satisfy or would try to satisfy, if you've already satisfied them, what does adultery have to offer? This is how many sins can be fought. So many sins involve trying to use God's gifts in the wrong way. The best way to avoid using God's gifts in the wrong way is to use them in the right way. Use them in the way he intended you to use them. So the comparison here is between the desires that we're talking about, and another desire. Desire for water, the desire of thirst, which in a semi-arid region like Israel was, it was a very helpful comparison because people were often thirsty. They needed water. So we've seen in Genesis the way that if you had a well, that was a hotly contested thing. Somebody's going to want that well. I mean, Abraham, he had fights over a well that he dug. Isaac had the same fights, I think, over the same well. So people really coveted these wells and these cisterns. But when you actually have the cistern, when it's yours, you can actually drink from it. without any trouble. The idea is that this is your water supply in a place where water's scarce, then it's a blessing to have one of these wells. It's a blessing to have a cistern. So really what the Father's saying is drink up. Saying in verse 15, drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Cisterns and wells were a little bit different. So a cistern is basically this stone cavity that collected rainwater. And so when Ken and I were in Israel, one of the places we got to see was Masada. It's this fortress out in the desert along the Dead Sea. And obviously, if you have a fortress in a desert area, you're going to need water. Otherwise, it's not going to be a very effective fortress. If you're hauled up there and there's no water, you're going to be in trouble. So what they did is they designed these cisterns. And they designed these channels along the mountain ridges to collect water when it did come. So there were times where it would rain. And instead of letting that water just rush down into the Dead Sea, it would go along these channels and fill up the cisterns. So then you also, it mentions wells. Wells are these things that you dig down and you try to hit into an aquifer. So there's actually a spring that's feeding that well and continually feeding it. So in both cases, you have access to water in an area where you really need access to water. And so what this is saying again is when that water, that source of refreshment, that source of satisfaction belongs to you, when it's for you, God says, drink up. That's what it's there for. That's why these sexual desires were given, so that they would be satisfied the correct way. So when you're doing that, when it's within marriage, satisfy them. It's good to do that. Now, he goes on to compare that with other ways of trying to satisfy that. And he says, what good is water to be scattered abroad? Again, there's a lot of debate about what this is talking about, but often you can try to take the details and connect them a little too closely. This is poetry. Poets like to use imagery to reach the heart. So we are just thinking in terms of drinking and drinking, being refreshed by water. But when you think about different water supplies, that's really what he talks about. He talks about springs and streams of water. Springs are those things that naturally occur, naturally flow. And then these streams of water could be translated channels of water. This is where you direct water from something else. So either rainwater or from a river, but it connects back to the cisterns and wells. The point is, he makes a comparison then about where the water goes. It goes to the streets and the public square or the plaza. So if you think about collecting water from the streets or collecting water from a public square or a plaza, that's not what you want. It's not a clean place, especially in an agrarian society. The streets weren't that clean. You had animals walking up and down the street, and they like to unload certain things randomly. And they didn't have modern sanitation, you know, in terms of for just your own household. So the streets were a very dirty place to get water from. That's the point that he's describing here. This is not where you want to be getting water from. So the kind of person who is willing to sleep with a married man or woman, they're often willing to sleep with other people too. Ready, willing to sleep with many different people. The world presents that as a normal reality. World presents that as that's normal, and that's okay, and that's good. But the fact of the matter is that complicates reality. So if somebody is experienced, there is nothing you can do to stop your mind from making comparisons. So it is more complicated the minute there's more than one person involved in this kind of intimacy. God designed us. He didn't design us so we all had to be Don Juan and figure out how to be the best at this. What he did is he designed it so that we just, through an actual concern and sensitivity to another person, learn another person. Learn how to both satisfy and be satisfied by another person. There's a simplicity to God's design. It's not complicated. And the reality is, when you don't know what else is out there, when you're not distracted by it, or when you're not distracted by images about it, you can enjoy your spouse. You're not thinking, oh, I wish this were the case. So what Proverbs is describing here is saying that sleeping with multiple people muddies the water and it's not good, and it's not as refreshing. Instead, find refreshment in someone who is for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. That's the ideal. So don't ever let anybody ever make you think that it really is better to make sure and figure things out with other people, or that it's good to be with more than one person. Now you could ask, well, how do you know that, Kurt? How do you know? I'll let you in on a little secret. The only reason why I know this is because God told me. He's telling you now. I mean, the reality is there's different opinions, right? But the person who has done this and maybe trying to justify going out and doing it with more than one person, they have no way of comparing what it would have been like to do it God's way. There are no ways to compare these two worlds. Either you're doing it God's way or you're not doing it God's way. And one person can say, my way's best. And another person can say, their way's best. How do we arbitrate this? I'll tell you the way that I would do it. The way that I would do it is, would I trust a finite being, or would I trust an omniscient, omnipotent being who designed me? You can tell where my money's going to be. I'm going to go with the person who designed me. That's what I think is the best. So if I believe that this is God's word, I'm going to trust God, and I'm going to say he knows what is best. So verse 18 gives us even more encouragement here. It says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. That word blessed, it makes us think about the creator who blessed marriage from the beginning. This is the God who made marriage. So continuing this image of satisfying your thirst, he describes it as a fountain. He's, again, blessing this. He's saying, drink up, enjoy. We should not be like Leonardo DiCaprio. If you're familiar with his lifestyle, he's known in Hollywood for always dating younger women. In fact, Ricky Gervais, he summed it up by saying that DiCaprio once attended a premiere for one of his movies that was 3 hours long. And he says by the end of the movie, his date was too old for him. That is not the way that we ought to be, right? That's what he's getting at with the wife of your youth. He's saying, stick with your spouse that you started with from the very beginning. That is the best thing. It is not good to trade your spouse for a younger model, ever. When we follow God's design, the fact is that your satisfaction grows with your relationship with your spouse. It may change from time, through time. It does change through time. But it is just as satisfying to stick with your spouse that you got with in your youth. Verse 19 is one of those verses that can give you a double take if you think God is a prude. It begins with this description of his son's wife as a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Now, we aren't as comfortable with comparing people to these kind of animals, but they did, both male and female. They would compare them, and it was a positive thing. These are good compliments describing beauty. But the words associated with them, I think they're taken a little differently than they come across here. More literally, you could translate it deer of love or lovemaking, and a doe of grace or favor. So you could understand these objects as what they bring. So this lovely creature provides both lovemaking and favor. It's just a positive description of what this person provides. And then the text reads, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Again, don't be a prude. This is in the Bible. If you're an adult, especially if you're a married adult, again, you should read that and reread it. And understand that this is from the perspective of a father passing on to a son, and similar parallel ideas could be made in reverse. The fact is, the emphasis here is on these words, at all times and always. So it's talking about extent in time and continuity in time. This should last, and it should continuously be true. When you're not comparing your spouse with other people or other images of people, this is what can be true. You can delight and be intoxicated, in fact. So it describes, filling is a word that's talking about that same drinking kind of metaphor. You can delight in that drink And then it describes it as intoxicating. It's more literally saying that they cause you to stagger, like intoxication can do. I'm not talking about that from experience, but you know what I'm saying. You get a little tipsy, right? They're saying the same thing happens in lovemaking. You can get a little bit topsy-turvy in your response to that physically. So for husbands and wives, your knees should only weaken for your spouse. And that can be true if you're committed only to your spouse. And it's a lifelong satisfaction that you can find there. So adultery is counterfeit. It's a knockoff. It is not. It tries to present itself as the real McCoy, but it's a fake. It cannot provide what the real deal can. And so marital intimacy is the best way to fight off adultery, because it actually provides what people think adultery is going to provide. So this is encouraging us to stay off the path of adultery by taking its antidote. Satisfaction, the way God designed it. When you drink deeply of that gift, you aren't going to go off and try to use that gift inappropriately. The fourth and final way to stay off the path of adultery is to recognize the reality. What our society presents as reality in the end is misinformation. So it's easy to fall for it, though. I mean, when everybody around you is saying the same thing, how can everyone be wrong? Isn't that? I mean, it seems like everybody else is saying something different. How can they be wrong? I mean, how can an ancient book know better than modern people? That seems crazy. It's the hardest thing to explain to people, though, when they don't have the Spirit's work in them. So when they haven't had their eyes open to see the truth about themselves, it's a lot harder. But once you come to see that you aren't a neutral person, just doing your best to take in information, live the best life you can. Once you see that there is something wrong with you, as we say, something wrong with all of us. Once you realize that you were never meant to be separated from God and to try to live life in that separation. And you realize that that explains why you so consistently let yourself and others down. Once God opens your eyes to see that, to see that you need him, then the blinders come off and you can see reality the way it actually is. So that's when a question like verse 20 actually starts to make sense. The question's not really asking why. It's a rhetorical question. It's meant to be read as, why in the world would you ever be intoxicated with love from someone who's not your spouse? Why would you ever hold on to her in that kind of intimate embrace? When you understand reality the way that God tells you it is, it's obvious that that should never be the case. So verse 21 begins to explain reality. It says, your ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all your paths. This is what our world does not pay attention to. It's not just that God knows what we've been doing. He's actually evaluating what we've been doing and what we do. And as I've said before, that is the only basis for morality. So if there is no moral being who stands behind reality, there is no such thing as morality. That is just a human construct. People could argue for the benefits of different parts of morality, but it would still just be somebody who is trying to control other people for what they think is best. If there isn't a moral God behind it all, it wouldn't actually be right and actually wrong. There'd be no basis for describing or believing that anything is evil. Every attempt to categorize or judge any action would just be a power play in the end. Someone try to manipulate somebody else to do what they think is best for them and others. There'd be no justification for good. It'd just be a mere opinion. But the Bible says there is a God. It says that he's holy. It says that he made us a certain way to reflect that holiness. We're supposed to have a relationship with him so that we know him, so that we know what he's like. We know about his love and his righteousness, and we were meant to recognize how good that is. We were meant to want to live that out. And that's the basis for morality. That's the only reason why what you do matters. Only reason is if there is a God who made us, who's watching us, not as some distant watcher, just barely paying attention, but as a judge who is going to hold us accountable. That's the only reason why doing right or wrong matters. And beyond that, God's created a world that works a certain way. So verse 22 describes that order when it says, the iniquities of the wicked ensnare him, and he is held fast in the cords of his sin. So these are synonymous ideas, iniquity and sin, and they describe the failure to live the way that we were designed to live. And so these sin and iniquity, they don't help you live well. On this path of life, what they do is they trip you up. They ensnare you. Like Jacob Marley, you know, with his chains that he has, that he forged in life. Your sin ensnares you, holds you fast, and it makes you pay for them in the afterlife. So if you remember that part of Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, you have the ghost of Jacob Marley. He's Scrooge's business partner. He's the first to visit him, and he was just like Scrooge. He was just as uncaring and miserly as Scrooge, and he comes to warn him about what's going to happen to him. Same thing that has happened to Jacob Marley is going to happen to Scrooge. And so he describes these chains that he's now carrying. He says, I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Saying, I'm to blame for what I'm now paying for. And he's describing his punishment as what he forged in life. The sin that he committed, though he might not exactly put it that way, that's what ensnared him. That's what bound him. And it's not something that you necessarily see being paid for now, but you will pay for it in eternity. And so the foolish person who willingly pursues this sin, it says that they die for lack of discipline, and because of his great folly, he is led astray. That word led astray is actually the same word translated intoxicated in verses 19 and 20. So you have the staggering again. So, and if you don't stagger for just your spouse, if you stagger for someone else, then you're going to stagger in your folly, when it's too late, when you face these eternal consequences, because you did not listen. There was a lack of discipline on your part. You did not pay attention to that warning, that correction from God, that now is he's offering to us. By his word, he's offering that correction. The foolish person who does not pay attention to it will pay for it in the end. Now, in all of this that we've been talking about, I don't want you to miss what marriage has always been pointing to. Truth is, not everybody needs to be married. There are those that God describes as having gifts in other ways. There is what we've called, or what people have called, the gift of singleness based on what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. So marriage is not for everyone. It's not what life is all about. Ultimately, marriage is only a temporary part of God's plan. On the one hand, it was part of God's plan to fill the earth with image bearers. But on the other hand, it was always designed to point to another intimate relationship. So in Ephesians 5, Paul takes on the topic of marriage, and he looks back to Genesis, and he quotes from Genesis, and he sees something even there in Genesis that's pointing to something that God had always intended. God always intended marriage to point to Christ's relationship with the church. So marriage has always been something that was meant, intended to be a billboard pointing to Jesus. Reality is we were meant to have a relationship with God, an intimate relationship with God, not a sexual one, not one that is satisfied in those ways, but deeper than that actually, and actually more satisfying than that. And so what I would tell the person who's not married or no longer married is that you are not a second-class person. You are not less than anyone who is married. The fact of the matter is, if you know Christ, you have something even better than anyone experiencing marital intimacy now has. This is something that's true for everyone who knows Christ. What we have waiting for us is so much better than anything marriage offers. And it's really what marriage was all about in the first place. So in many ways, what instruction in Proverbs 5 is ultimately doing is it's pointing us not just to fidelity to our spouse, but to fidelity to God. So any idea that life without God, life with these other pursuits is better, it's the worst false advertising. There is nothing better than life with God. And there's only ruin and regret ultimately, eternally, outside of that relationship. That's the reality. And the antidote to this temptation that we can just live and choose for ourselves what's best for us, the antidote to thinking that way is to realize that what's best is Christ and what he's done for us. To realize that he came to give up his life for his bride. For everyone who will turn from their sin and believe in him, who will believe that he came to rescue them from their sin. Now, if you don't believe that, I would just encourage you that that's really what we want for everybody here, to believe that. And I would love to talk to you if you have any questions about that. That is what life is all about. Ultimately, it's about knowing Christ, knowing God through his Son, by his Spirit. So we set aside anything and everything that would take us away from him. And ultimately, that's what adultery is. It is a major distraction from Christ. It is a horrible path that ultimately leads you away from Christ forever. Stay off that path at all costs. That's what Proverbs 5 has been telling us to do. It tells us to do that by spotting the false advertising of adultery, avoiding the consequences of lifelong ruin and regret, taking the antidote, which is satisfaction in marriage, and recognizing the reality of life in God's world. Everything in life was made through and for Christ, and it is for our great enjoyment. Join me in prayer. Father, the hardest thing for us to convey is how good you are, how good it is to know you. I believe it's a psalmist who says, taste and see that the Lord is good. And, you know, Edwards talks about the difference between talking about how sweet honey is and tasting it. There's a lack of our ability to truly convey what our experience is like in knowing you. And we can tell people how great it is, but it's not the same as they're actually experiencing it. So as we compare these different things, we compare living life the way that you design it with not doing that, it's hard to really see just how much better your way is unless you're actually doing it. The satisfaction that it offers. And it's not without pain and difficulty. Everybody experiences pain and difficulty in life. But life with you is better. We ask that you would help us to dwell on that reality. That we would recognize that life with you is better and life your way is better. Keep us from the lies that are told that somehow the morality of our world, which has no basis, is better than the morality that you, the morality, has designed us for. Help us to dwell on that. And anyone who does not know you, pray that your warnings would reach their heart, that they would hear it, that they would be responsive, even by your Spirit. They would turn from living life the way they think is best, and that they would find that satisfaction, trusting in your Son and submitting to him. They would join us in doing that. Help us to enjoy our submission to you in the way that we love our spouse, in the way that we are committed to them, We ask that in a world full of failure, when we are not strong enough to maintain that fidelity in our own strength, we ask for your Spirit to produce in our hearts the kind of love that is able to do that. And we trust that you will do what you promise. We ask all these things because of your great love toward us in your Son. Amen.